Recently, we did a retrospective on Vietnam on Reality Check. This week in part two, we are looking at the war from this side of the ocean. The protests, the returning vets, the VA, the politics, and more. The war at home, this week on Reality Check on KCIW. We have with us Ray Gary, Dan Sherman, and Gary Blanchard, who were vets who were with us last time and talked about their experience. And joining us tonight is Marcia Thibodeau, who also knows something about PTSD. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for being here. Why don't we start off by picking up where we left off the last time? We were just about to the end of the war. And, you know, you weren't aware that it was ending yet, but as you became aware of that, what were your thoughts? What did you think was going on? It might just be the end of the war for you, then coming home. What was that like?
Well, I'd been home quite a while when it was over, and I was just glad that it was over. At the time, I was pretty right-wing, and I was kind of bummed that we had lost and were chased out by this third-world country, as I looked at it.
But when you found out you were coming home, what was your reaction? What were your thoughts? What was like to come back to the States?
In Vietnam, at least for the Army, you had a 12-month tour of duty. So everybody knew the day pretty much that they were going home. It was very exciting. I was in, if the situation allows, when you start getting short, they put you in a safer position where you're less likely to get hurt. And they gave me about 5 days to clear post, as they call it. You go around and the library signs you off and everybody signs you off that you've taken care of all your responsibilities.
Right.
So you can do that in about a half a day. And I was talking to a friend of mine and he said, well, when are you leaving? I said, well, 5 days. He says, oh, 5 days? He says, have you cleared post yet? I said, no. He said, come with me. So he took me down to the replacement center where a friend of his worked. And this guy was like something out of MASH. He would steal a Jeep on a regular basis and just change the numbers. And then when it got hot, he'd go park it someplace, steal another one. He had Connex containers full of black market stuff that he could sell and trade and things like that. But he was also the guy that did the scheduling for who gets on the plane. So first thing he said to me, you got your papers? Like he was going to put me on a plane right there. And I said, no. He said, how soon can you get them? Tomorrow? That afternoon, I was on a plane. Everybody in the company said, don't go down. You're just going to hang around there for 5 days. That afternoon, I was on my way home.
And what was it like when you got here? What was like your first impressions, the first few days or weeks or months?
You know, when I came back, there really was the head started all this hate towards Vietnam veterans and the so-called spitting on people and things like that occurred. And I just came home, got in an airplane in Oakland, flew to New York, and went home.
Tried to pick up the pieces of
your
life.
Yeah, I still had time in the Army, but I went home, and I can remember while I was home on leave, I wore my uniform. My wife and I went into a nice restaurant in New York City, and people were asking me about Vietnam and things like that, but I wasn't getting any flack for it. And as far as my own neighborhood, I was considered like, well, I'd had an article written about me in the New York News, so I was kind of a famous guy now in my neighborhood. And
right.
Yeah, people were saying, oh, hometown boy makes good. I don't know why I made good, but.
And you guys?
I have a question for Ray. Were you married while you were in Vietnam?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
So you got a follow-up question to that?
No.
Okay.
Why does that surprise you?
Because some of the guys that I served with were married, and I just pictured that as being extremely difficult. I wasn't at the time. I thought I had girlfriends waiting back home. Turns out I didn't. and I really remember that... what was it, the line from, in basic training, it was, ain't no use in looking back, Jody's driving your Cadillac, ain't no use in feeling blue, because Jody's got your girlfriend too, and that was the reality.
You know, the deal was in those days during the draft, you didn't get married because you knew you were going to get drafted. You didn't buy a new car, you didn't do a lot of things because you knew you were going to get drafted.
Yeah.
Well, I took my physical, just like Arlo Guthrie at Whitehall Street, and couple of weeks later, I got a letter in the mail saying I was 1Y. And so I said, oh, it was great. I wasn't going to go in the Army. But then I said, well, what the heck is 1Y? So I called them up, and they said, well, we're only taking the cream of the crop right now, and we're not taking people that wear glasses. And they said, women and children before you is what 1Y meant. Well,
wow.
It must have got a lot of women and children, because then Johnson did the big buildup, and they were taking everybody.
Mm-hmm. What about you guys? What was it like to come home?
Well, this is Gary, and if you remember from last time, I had a little different experience in Vietnam. I never saw combat.
Mm-hmm. But you came home later.
I did. I was there when Saigon fell. I was there from 1971 to 1975. And because of my security clearance, I did know that Saigon was falling. We saw that in some of the top secret traffic that would come across from the U.S. We were mispredicting the date. We had a date that was approximately 3 weeks beyond when it actually fell. But once the communists started moving into Saigon itself, everything was so accelerated. And really, the last 2 days, we were just simply destroying everything we could. We were doing air flights all the time to watch the traffic that was happening. I remember there was one thing I translated at the time, and it was orders from Hanoi. And the orders were, they always repeat it twice. And it's just stuck in my mind when I heard it. And it was, I'll say it in Vietnamese first, and then I'll translate it, but it's Tat ka mọi người chen ka pak kui ti ziet ngai. And they say that twice so that their soldiers don't misinterpret that. But it was such a significant thing, it really drove the war home to me for the first time, because what it says is everybody over the rank of second lieutenant should be killed immediately.
Whoa.
And I just hesitated. I just almost dropped everything I was doing at the time when I heard that. Because I had a lot of friends over there, one of which was an interpreter that I helped out afterwards. But the day it fell, I was transferred. Once that American flag came down off the embassy, there were flights out onto the aircraft carriers, inbound, people landing, private planes. Of course, I was airlifted helicopter to one of the carriers, and I don't remember which one it was at this time, but then I could see from the flight ops deck and from the CIC Combat Information Center, we could see planes trying to land that weren't equipped to land on a carrier. Mm-hmm. There were a few successful landings, crash landings on the deck, and of course they would clear those off into the water immediately. But most of those actually ended up in the drink right away.
But the sounds like it was just total chaos.
It was. And then since I was we only had three or four official interpreters, many, many people in country were interpreting for America, but there were only three or four of us who were officially recognized for it. And so because I was one of them, they transferred me then. Airlifted me. I took off from a jet off that carrier once I got on board, and the people stopped coming in, and then the carriers headed back towards Subic Bay, and they flew me back on a small jet, an A3 I think it was, to help with incoming wounded in Subic Bay, because the really severely wounded people, both from the that could have been wounded anywhere in Saigon or around the embassy or even in the evacuation itself, because it was just pandemonium. Those people were all transported into Subic Bay as fast as they could, the hospital there. And so I was helping with the wounded there, because a lot of doctors, you know, as they were examining these patients, some with head wounds, open head wounds, and they didn't want to put them out. And, you know, there are questions like, can you feel this, you know, when they're tweaking their toe or something. And so that lasted approximately 3 weeks, and then I was just flown back to Oakland. So I got an early out by probably 2 months. Mm-hmm. I was coming to the end of my time anyway. But because I was in something a little more unique than other soldiers, I never saw combat.
Sounds like you saw a lot, though, in this last chapter.
I did it right in the end in the hospital because there were egregiously wounded people, many of which I knew as friends, and many of which I became acquainted with and kept in contact over the years. But then, you know, I was in somewhat of a unique situation, so my hair was a little longer than most military.
I also
had facial hair, had a mustache anyway, which, you know, most people could not do.
Right.
Then. So when I got back to Oakland, I was processed, took about 3 days to process me out, and then I flew back to Minneapolis, and you know, I changed my clothes, and I kind of fit right in. Nobody knew that I had been in Vietnam, so
were you kind of wanting to blend in on purpose?
I kind of was, yeah. There was a lot of animosity, a lot of protests and things like that, but I never faced the discrimination that some of the obvious military people did at that time. I went right back into school, and it was totally different for me.
I was in California, so what do I know? But I wasn't aware of people having these overt reactions to people coming home. I imagine that's so, but I think I was more aware of sort of these unwritten rules. And I don't know if this would make any sense to you, but I felt like I wasn't supposed to ask anybody about their experience because it probably was awful in some way that they might not want to talk about, and it would be like very invasive to them.
My wife didn't for years.
Yeah, I didn't.
For,
I was
for the
married
same
to
reason, I wasn't reluctant to talk about it. In fact, I was kind of wondered why she wasn't curious about it. But
yeah, retrospectively, yeah, she probably would have been healthy, but I never asked my husband either.
Yeah, she felt like it was like an invasion or something that she didn't need to.
I had kind of a different experience because I really didn't understand what was going on. Yes, I was in California, and I was liberal, but I didn't have anyone in my family that was in the military. My father had been injured. My brothers had been in reserves. And I didn't have any friends that were in the military, but some I knew were conscientious objectors and went to Canada. So my attitude was totally against the war. And I understand when the soldiers came back, there certainly wasn't a ticker tape parade. There was a lot of dissension. And I now understand better, but I visited a friend in San Francisco who was in the military, and the whole room of all these poor men who were, most of them, paraplegic. And I just remember it was this white room that had nothing but beds in it with men who were missing limbs and were being just turned because they were paralyzed. And it was such a shock for me. But still, I kept thinking, but why did you go? The war is wrong. I don't understand why you did that. So I don't think I totally understood for many years after of what my attitude was for these people who had gone and been in this horrific war.
Most of us were too stupid to realize what we were getting into.
We were young, dumb kids.
Exactly.
And a lot of you were drafted.
And my government said this is what we're supposed to do. We're fighting communism. We're keeping communism. Communism has a big, horrible word, communism, from spreading. I thought that I should be there. I didn't want to be there. But I thought, well, it's...
Yeah.
It's my generation's war. Everybody else has gone to war. It's now it's my turn.
Yeah, I too thought it was my patriotic duty because, you know, what you saw on the news and everything was that this monolithic domino theory of communism was going to take over the world, and we had to stop it there. And so in the beginning, that's why I went in. Now, when I was in college, I was angry, actually, when protesters tried to hold me out of classrooms and stuff because I was, had to work and my scholarships were dependent on me making good academic progress and stuff. And I was afraid to miss classes and stuff. And there were people initially at the university trying to hold you out of classes. And I got angry at them and almost punched one out. But then my attitudes changed once I got in the service and I saw what was really happening. And that's when I got more of an education of what things were really about.
My experience was so different from that. You know, I was mildly protesting like a lot of people that were stateside. But the way it really came home to me is that I had all my male friends who were susceptible to this draft. And we didn't know what the war was about or why it was happening. It sounded like a bad idea. And, you know, they all were having to change their life path in order to avoid the draft. Some of them went to Canada. Some of them, you know, tried these weird schemes to get out of it. A lot of them were just staying in school as long as they could, even though they didn't want to be there. And it was this huge waste of effort in a way, you know, waste of their life energy, because nobody wanted to go, at least at the point that I was aware of it. Like I said, I was in California, so what do you expect? But it was so different. And, you know, what I didn't understand is putting these great people at risk for reasons that nobody could explain to me.
Another thing that I felt is that when the soldiers came back, the world was a very different place. And people that they knew that had not gone in the service already had careers. They already had education. They already had financial security. And here they're coming out, and there's this animosity against what they've done, risking their life, living in this horrific situation daily. And where did they fit? You know, where was the place for them? Because everybody had already moved way beyond where they were and was prepared or had families or had support, social support, and they didn't. So I just think that was a huge problem for the guys coming back.
One of the things that I remember was that when I came back and I was looking for a job, some sort of something to do. And so I went around to all these different places and filled out job applications. And I don't know if they still do this anymore, but I remember that it would say military service. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I proudly wrote in what branch of the service and when I served and all of that. And what I realize now is that that may have been the reason why I wasn't hired for that particular job.
Because it was a stereotype attached to it.
Because there was this, and this was early on in this whole scheme of things. I mean, I don't recall any protesting going on at the time or anything, but still, nonetheless, when I think about who my prospective employer might have been and what that person's attitude might have been toward the war, to me, it just seems like it was a real slap in the face. I didn't realize it at the time. I just thought, well, I didn't get the job. But now that I look at it from this point in time, I see it differently. So it's a supreme insult that a country asks, for whatever the reason, asks its citizens, or doesn't ask, or just flat demands and says, you, come here, here's a rifle, go kill that guy. And so you go through all of this, and then you come back at the end of that, and there's no warm welcome, it's rejection.
Yeah.
So.
And there was no support, no counseling support.
Right.
I mean, and so many, whether they had Agent Orange or whatever it was that they came back with, they were not getting the medical support or the psychiatric support because they were saying, oh, no, we never experimented on our soldiers. Or, oh, no, you didn't really have the experience that they're saying they did. And so they didn't even have the support from the government when they got back.
And we didn't even have the word PTSD in those days.
No.
The man I was married to, he suffered the whole time of our marriage for the 7 years I was with him, horribly. Nightmares, all the classic things of jumping out of bed ready to attack somebody, usually me because I was the only person there. You know, all that goofy stuff. And he was miserable. Migraine, headaches. I mean, it was a long list of stuff. And just a total inability to ground himself in this life here. I think it explained a lot of the drop out part of the movement that was going on there, because people just couldn't relate to being back here.
I think one of the results of me being so apathetic at the time was I am kind of a pain now politically. I mean, the back of my car is covered with bumper stickers, and I wear these T-shirts, and I host a music show that's basically protest music, and I firmly believe you should have the courage to stand up for your convictions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people ask me, aren't you afraid of getting your windows broken out? I've never had any. The only time I've ever had a car vandalized was the pickup truck I own now, was when it was like brand new, and I didn't have any stickers on it yet. Somebody had keyed it, but. My wife has had some, we have an upside down American flag on the back of our car, and my wife's had some people make comments to her, but I've only had one make a comment to me. I guess it's easier to talk to a woman than a 6 foot tall guy.
Yeah, well, I've been called out in the middle of Kitanishi restaurant before by people that didn't like my political opinions.
Really?
That I was trying to just say to my friend sitting next to me, but I got overheard, and that was the beginning of the end. Yeah, and it was a little bit scary, but you know. Nothing happened along
the way. One thing I'd like to interject on Ray's comment about the upside-down American flag. Some listening may think it's an unpatriotic gesture, but actually an upside-down American flag is simply an international distress signal.
Exactly.
And that's sort of, I think,
it's not disrespecting the flag at all.
Right.
Yeah. I know one of the things that I wanted to think about a little bit getting ready for this was how polarized the country was. It wasn't just Vietnam, but it became a thing where anybody who had long hair was a bad person in other people's minds, and vice versa. And there were, you know, the police were just so aggressive. I remember going to a celebration at Griffith Park. And, you know, people brought their dogs and their kids and their picnic baskets and were sitting in the sun on blankets and so on, little kids running around in bare feet. And the police came and dumped the garbage cans upside down that were full of glass bottles. And they broke them with their nightsticks so that they'd be glass all in the grass and the people would cut their feet. And then Country Joe, I think it was at the mic and saying, you know, just chill, don't react. And but then we chose as a group, like there were thousands of us, to just go home. And we had to walk in front of, I mean, inches away from shoulder to shoulder guys in riot gear all the way down the hill to our cars. And it was really scary. And that was just one experience. And it was so uncalled for. But that's where we were at in those days.
Well, we were threatening a way of life, you know. I think by Summer of Love or whatever it was that we were involved in.
Rock and roll.
Yeah. It was really frightening, I think, for the status quo, because who were all these people that were getting together and they were breaking a lot of rules that society had based itself on? And I think we scared them.
Yeah.
And I was paying a mortgage and cutting grass. I wasted all those years of my life when I could have been having fun on Long Island, of all places.
There's that.
Now, according to this book called Passages from way back many years ago, you have to go through your hippie years. And Ray, I'm sorry that you finally got around to this so late.
Yeah.
Well, better late than never.
That's right.
I have a theory that it doesn't have much to do with the discussion, but retirement is backwards. You should retire when you're 23 and go to work when you're 65. And that way you have all those years.
That's pretty much what I did.
All those years when you have energy and interest in doing things, and you can do them.
Mm-hmm. I kind of did that too, but it's hard to catch up when you are getting a little bit older and you're supposed to be in your 20s.
So at the risk of sounding like Dr. Phil, you know, we talked about these experiences that you had last time we got together. Have any of you had like a change in your thoughts about it or other things coming up just since we talked?
Hmm.
Or maybe
no, I don't think so. Not for me. I mean, I think at this point I've gone through periods of time in my life when I have tried to make sense of everything, mm-hmm. and including like one of the things I went through a period of time in right after Vietnam when I started asking questions like, okay, why does Hitler, why was he allowed to exist? If there's really a God, then how come Mussolini killed all those people and all that sort of stuff? And,
right.
And it's not something that I'm going to say that I've got it all figured out or anything like that at the risk of being existentialistic, like you said earlier. But it's the, and for me, the latest thing that I had was Ray suggested that I watch the Ken Burns documentary, and I was not aware of all of the history that went before I got to Vietnam.
Right.
I kind of watched everything that went on post-Vietnam, but knowing and understanding that history and then putting that into perspective with my father's perspective on what the war was all about. Now, he never was in combat. The war ended as soon as he finished training. He was a pilot for the Army.
Are we talking about Korean War or World War II?
World War II.
Okay.
And so listening to him and his take on the politics, world politics, particularly post-World War II, where the Russians essentially went over and chopped up Germany, and there was all this shuffling of land here and land there between all of these powers. And yes, it was pretty easy to see that there were some world powers that generally wanted to be fairly ruthless about what gains they could get from all of this. And so I understood that it's a struggle. There is a world political struggle, and it's still going on today. It's not
in
like
a
it was all settled
way,
or anything. So basically, it helped me to understand how people who were very much afraid of various world powers at that time said, "Well, we have to do something to keep this from that," and that's how Vietnam came into play with this.
The whole domino theory and
yeah,
all that.
Yeah, but I'm also very much aware that, for example, I heard that, and I snoped it, and I found out that it's true. I don't remember whether if it was Johnson himself or his wife, had significant investment in Bell Helicopter. War was a good thing financially for them.
Yeah, use up a lot of helicopters.
Yeah, and then there are things that, like, for example, I think the Civil War, I think both sides of that war were financed by the same English banks. There are a lot of interesting things in world politics, and so, sure, I'm open-minded to anything new that comes down the pike, that I can read about it, but my whole thought process at this point is I just kind of sit back and take this philosophical existential point of view on it. And for me, I find some comfort in that because it means I don't have to remember the nasty stuff that I don't really want to remember.
The idea of there being profit in war, during the Vietnam War, that was one of the things the protesters were saying, is that DuPont and all these people are getting rich. And I can remember thinking, now, how could anybody fight a war just to get rich? How could anybody possibly kill one person, let alone 500 a week? And that's the way I thought then. I don't think that way anymore, though.
And the other thing that I've heard people say about fighting wars is it takes the pressure off of the situation at home. Like in the most recent seasons of House of Cards, where he's getting into hot water, so he creates a lot of fear,
yeah,
which drives people to want to go to war to, quote, protect themselves. And that's not that unusual. I mean, that's a dramatization, but I think it's happened in the real world as well.
Wag the dog.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that just occurred to me, World War II, for me, and I think for probably most Americans, was justified. We were fighting this horrible Hitler who wanted
to take
over the world.
Wasn't a lot of gray area there, was there?
Yeah, we were definitely fighting. I mean, to have Germany invading Russia right up almost, to the gates of Moscow, That's pretty significant.
Well, and France Germany fell and yeah. everybody else along the way.
Yeah.
Well, Germany declared war on us, so.
Yeah, and Pearl Harbor, you know, really galvanized the American mm-hmm. spirit against yeah. against the Axis powers.
Yeah. We had to do something then.
But getting back to Vietnam, in retrospect, and I'm not up on the political situation of those times, even though we, quote, lost, did we win in any kind of way? Was there a good outcome for having been there, or was it just completely a mistake from beginning to end?
I think maybe the thing that we may have gained, maybe the thing we may have gained is that most of us have learned now to keep an eye on our government, that just because a politician says something, it's not true. I think we have that awareness and some of the naivete of us just believing whatever the government says is probably gone.
I think that's true, but when I look at what's happening now, I kept thinking we would learn from Vietnam. And now I feel saddened because what have we learned? Where are we standing now? How different is it? Yes, we're more aware that we need to be involved and we need to educate ourselves about what's going on. But I just don't feel the lesson was really...
What's the old adage? The thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history.
So specifically with Vietnam, do you think that it did, even though, you know, we didn't succeed, but was there a way that it did stop communism from moving into the South, what is that, Southeast Asia?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm getting some nods.
Yeah. I think there was a good lesson there that most of America learned, and it's not often spoken of, and that's that, you know, once the Saigon government fell and the North Vietnamese swept in and renamed the city to Ho Chi Minh City, but the entire South Vietnam then became communist, in theory anyway, and I think America should have learned that we no longer need fear monolithic communism and the domino theory. Because
mm-hmm.
we saw that wasn't true. It didn't. Communism didn't go on and extend to all the rest of Southeast Asia. It more or less stopped there.
Do you think that us being there had any influence in that, or do you think it just wasn't going
to
do that anyhow?
Well, it certainly made Americans pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that lesson, like Marcia said, is lost today.
Yeah.
And I don't think it works. Communism works.
Mm-mm.
So that was, you know, I think the thing that was most true for me. As a young person, I kept thinking, now, wait a minute, I don't understand. We hate the Japanese, we hate the Russians, and all these countries we hate, and then, oh, wait, now they're our friends, and now we're dealing with them. So where's the end point here? That there's times when you hate them and you want to destroy them, and then you can strike up a good financial deal with them. So that was so confusing to me.
Well, we talk about the horrors that Germany did, but, you know, all through many, many, many years, England wasn't a very nice country either. Their colonialism and their massacres for people that rose up against their colonialism and things like that. They didn't kill 6 million people in concentration camps, but they certainly did a lot.
Well, they did strange things like they tried to sell drugs in Hong Kong, and I think it was Hong Kong. I'd have to do a fact check of this, but the English, they didn't particularly like the fact that the Chinese weren't willing to buy their drugs, so they sent warships up the river and essentially bombarded the government until they said, okay, we'll buy your stinking drugs. And I had a friend who was English, and he was probably 15, 16 during World War II. I mean, he was a teenager when it was, and he used to tell stories about the buzz bombs flying overhead and stuff. And he was fun because he would say things from the English point of view, even though he had American citizenship. And he would say, you know, you Americans just haven't figured this out yet. If you're going to colonize something, then you have to da-da-da-da-da, and he'd lay it out. And he was perfectly aware of how England basically tried to colonize all of these in their own self-interest, of course. I mean, if they wanted sugar, why buy the sugar if you can just take it? So you colonize the place. And so it was for resources. And it seems like, I think it was Alan Watts, who was a contemporary philosopher of the 60s, who brought Eastern thought to the West. And he essentially said, you know, some people fight wars for entirely the wrong reasons. They're ideological about it. He says, what's the gain in that? He says, no, you should go to plunder the countryside and take the resources. and he was English. No, he was Scottish. Yeah.
Right, right. So you guys are vets. Did you get things out of having been a vet, like the GI Bill type things, the veterans benefits?
I hated every second that I was in the Army. Absolutely could not stand it. But because of the Army, I went to college with a GI Bill. I have some medical coverage now that I don't need because my private coverage is better, although I did get hearing aids and things like that from the VA. Having a state job, I got points on my job application, so I had extra credit. I more than likely got the job as quickly as I did because of being a veteran.
So I learned
that my little provincial world in Bethpage, Long Island, was not the entire world, that there were other places, there were other people and fun things to do and places to go. I would probably still be there, as we said in the last program, on the loading dock someplace if I had not been in the Army.
Hmm, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'm 100%. And
100%?
That's how the VA rates you. And it was really kind of funny because, I mean, I went in. I had just gone for many, many years and not even thought about it or anything. And then I had a friend said, why don't you go to the VA? And so when I got there, the first thing that I discovered was that Agent Orange, if you were on country, even if you were on a ship, it was assumed you went on country somewhere or somehow you were exposed to Agent Orange. So that was automatic. And then they said, so how's your hearing? And so on and so on. So now I've got, you know, like 10% for hearing and 30% for Agent Orange something or other, and this for the prostate cancer and that for my ischemic heart disease and so on and so on. And all this adds up to be, you know, 33,000 or something like that. No, not that big, but, you know, it's well over 100%. But they don't add them up like that. They just, you know, they give you part of this and part of that, and they have some sort of a system. But
So this is like a disability benefit, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, I get a monthly check.
Oh.
And essentially that's my livelihood these days. I mean, if that goes away, I'll be out there on the streets with everybody else.
And, I could use a gardener.
Okay, yeah, I could do that. But, yeah, I mean, I went through the whole VA process and got...
So, personally, no complaints from you guys about the VA. They've done good by it. Because it's been an ongoing nightmare from what you hear in the news.
I had a very limited use of the VA. My sister, when I got home, was much older than me, told me about, you know, you can go to college now. You have this VA benefit. You ought to go. So... I went into the VA office and I filled out some paperwork, and then I went to the college and enrolled in some night classes, and I had no problem at all with the VA. Now, I was able to, when I got out of the Army, walk right back into the job I had in the exact same position. But people who worked for a company that had, say, 6 or 7 employees, and they've replaced you, and now they have to fire somebody to give you your job back, and a lot of those guys never did get their jobs back. And when I got out of the Army, there was really tough employment times, too.
Yeah, and I also took advantage of the GI Bill to go back to college, and they give you a good deal on your, well, you should know that, being in real estate, that if you've got the
great
VA
financing.
Paperwork, yeah, you get a better deal on...
No money down.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also took advantage of the GI Bill because when I came back, I changed... the focus of my undergraduate degree, and also it paid for part of my master's too. So that was a real benefit to me.
Are you having trouble finding work as an interpreter?
Learning Vietnamese comes in handy in the restaurants, right?
You order well.
Dan and I just went to a, what do they call it, at the VA, that meeting we went to, or the...
A town hall.
A town hall, yeah. And apparently Dan and I have had good experiences where at least the people there, a lot of them did not have good experience, a lot of complaints about meds and all kinds of things.
I know my coworker, her husband, apparently he was in either a helicopter or a plane. I suppose it might have been a helicopter. And they were dropping that stuff, Agent Orange and some white phosphorus stuff.
I had a good friend who was a ranch hand. And those are the guys that fly the planes. It's called the ranch hand. And I remember him telling me that he was covered with it a lot. You see, he had no ill effects on it at all.
Well,
and then not too many years after that, though, he got some major heart problems and really was badly affected by Agent Orange. In fact,
my brother-in-law it was dropped on their whole unit, actually. And he died of brain cancer just probably 10 years after Vietnam.
Well, this fellow, apparently they won't honor his benefits in the way that you were honored because he was in a plane. They said he wasn't exposed, which apparently is not possible.
Well, that's changed now.
It is?
Yeah. Well,
because this is very recent, and the thing
I've discovered politically speaking is that depending on who's running the administration, and by that I mean, like, you know, it can change from, you know, like a Republican president to a Democratic president, but basically the government is either sympathetic to the needs of the vets or it's not. And if you talk with a lot of these old vets, they'll say, yeah, well, I remember when they tried to cut my benefits, blah, 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 and that was when so-and-so was in office. Mm-hmm. And they just attribute it to, well, you know how politicians are. But I've seen the ebb and the flow of how an administration reacts to the whole issue of vets.
There's a list of things that they attribute to Agent Orange or could be caused by Agent. I think there's about seven things, prostate cancer being one of them, and a few other things. And if you were in Vietnam at all, regardless of where you were, and you get one of those, it's like automatically you get a pension. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Am I correct on that, Tim?
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, even if you're only there like for a day or in a short period of time.
I know they sprayed around the compound the one time that I was out in the field. I was basically out away from the cities and all that for I don't remember how long, but a few months. But what I remember was that on the perimeter we had the towers and the guys with the machine guns and they sprayed for several hundred yards beyond the perimeter.
To defoliate everything
so nobody could sneak up on the compound.
So it was just
right outside there. We went outside the compound. We were on boats, but, you know, we were in close to shore a lot of times too, and in those areas.
I was talking with someone, Gordon Clay, actually, and he was saying that in our county last year there were 14 suicides, mm-hmm. five of which were vets, which is a fairly high percentage. I would think mm-hmm. that there aren't proportionally that many vets here, although we do have a lot.
There was a period of time when I thought about it. It was from nightmares. I would wake up with these nightmares, and I just really felt horrible. Still do if I have a nightmare. They're not as frequent as they used to be, but
even now, it's been so long.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And it's things that can trigger it. It's like, you know, if I'm feeling particularly stressed, if some particular something happens, and it's like, I know a lot of vets, they don't like the smell of diesel fuel.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be a fairly common trigger.
That stayed with me for quite a while after I came back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it wasn't that I didn't like it. It was, well, smells trigger memories anyway.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And if I was behind a diesel truck, because I used to ride in convoys, a bit, and yeah, that just instantly brought me right back.
Wow.
Well, and don't forget, that's the way that we got rid of our sewage problems.
Yeah.
You know, you went to the latrine and
burned it up,
and it was in a can,
55-gallon drum.
Yeah,
cut
the
off,
bottom yeah. bottom part of it, and they filled it with diesel fuel, and then every morning, you know, they'd have somebody come along and they'd take them out and they'd light them on fire, and yeah, there's smells.
Yeah. That used to be that was a detail.
Yeah,
and you think, oh, that's the worst detail, but it actually was not a bad detail, because you drug these cans out with a that had like a big hook. You drug them away from the latrine, then you poured diesel fuel on them, and you lit the diesel fuel, and then you went away, and you came back a half hour, 40. It was the easiest detail there could be,
because you had all that
yeah,
downtime.
Yeah, you go hang out
waiting
in the
for it to burn
or whatever while it was burning,
yeah.
and the.
Well, Marcia, you did some study about PTSD. Do you have anything to add about how, I mean, this is really amazing to me that people are still having nightmares all half a century later.
Well, when you think of the horrors that they've experienced and that they've seen, it's no wonder. And I know, as mentioned before, about the difficulty talking about it, which is really the best solution if it's possible. Being with people that you trust, being with other people who have experienced it, is the best way to be able to get some of it out there, because it isn't something that anyone can live with. I mean, these are horrors that they've had to go through. But some of it is anxiety, some of it's depression, some of it is anger. There's all these different parts that they're experiencing.
I'm just now getting over the anger.
Right, and it's finding what works. You know, it's important if one were to see a therapist to really find one that has the same values and that you feel as though they understand post-traumatic stress, that they have also had similar experiences, because most of us just can't possibly understand what they've had to experience. But a lot of with the depression, eating well, trying to get good sleep, trying to be able to exercise, all these things that help with depression. And anger, it's if there's some way of finding ways of soothing yourself, whether it's being able to recognize physiologically what happens in your body before the anger onset. That way you can kind of tell, oh, it's starting to happen, and it can be tension in your body, or it can be a tightening of your throat or any of that, and then you know what to do. Get into another place, you know, a timeout or something, some soothing thing that you can do. And there's lots of different treatments. Some go with the medication, whether it's antidepressants or mood stabilizers or antipsychotics. Some people, homeopathics help with herbs. But I think the important thing is to not isolate yourself if you can help it, to stay involved socially to the best of your ability, and to be able to talk to other people that can share this. And not only do vets go through this, but certainly first responders, firemen, I mean, and you know, Ray as being a medic, I mean, there's so many in our world who are suffering from different degrees of post-traumatic stress. And it's...
Even people who've had a rough childhood get PTSD.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Sexual abuse, child abuse, any of those kinds of things. But so often there's the desire to isolate yourself and not talk about it, because you don't want it to you don't want to remember it. You don't want it to come up again. And almost the fear, if I talk about it, it's going to be present again. Well, it's going to be there anyway. It's just it comes out in night terrors, or it comes out in physical illness, comes out in many different ways. And so if there's a possibility of getting a social support, whether it's joining groups or talking to loved ones. And you're right, Ray, when you say it's hard for other people to hear it, some people don't ask you about it because they can't handle it themselves. because it's some people feel guilty because they didn't go.
I think in my case, my wife just felt like it was a part of my life. She didn't necessarily want to win. I don't think it would bother her to hear this stuff. I have a Bronze Star, and she only asked me about 2 years ago how I happened to get that Bronze Star. So,
wow. Yeah.
I was not a hero, by the way. I was in a wrong place at the wrong time.
You could be a hero. That's okay.
No, but I wasn't.
One of the things that occurred to me, Marcia, you were talking about connecting with people, and that's one of the things that I remember, and I still have this same this is something that some counselor summer told me was characteristic of PTSD, and that's the issue of trust. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you mean trust? I mean, you walk into a room, it's full of people you don't know. I feel real uneasy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't sit with my back to the door. I like to sit with my back to a wall where I can observe the entire room. If I am walking down an aisle in the supermarket and I see somebody, I immediately have to size them up and ask myself, are they bigger than I am? Do they look dangerous?
And that's all training too, right? From when you were there as well.
I think so, because I know that for a number of the regular Vietnamese Army troops that were there, it was said that a lot of them were Viet Cong, and that you couldn't trust any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw some things that made me think, well, can I even trust the guys that I am with?
Yeah.
It comes out in small ways. I remember I was in the military police, and I remember one of the things that the other guy was in charge of the shift, and he was driving, and we pulled over a couple, and I stayed in the car, and he went out and talked with a guy, and he came back, and he says, man, I hate to see that. And I said, what? And he said, that's a black guy. He didn't call him a black guy because that wasn't the
right
term at the time. And he says, and he's got a blonde with him. A white chick.
Yeah.
And he was just seething, and I thought, this isn't somebody that I trust. I'm mm-hmm. sorry. I don't trust someone who categorizes other people, whether if they're Viet Cong or they're
right
minorities or whatever. I mean, for me, there's an element of, do I really trust them? And the answer is no.
And that's part of the hypervigilance, too.
Yes.
With post-traumatic stress, but it's a survival skill.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think so many people don't realize, is the things that you came back with were possibly the reason that you survived. But it's a matter of degree. You no longer need it here,
right,
in this society.
Maybe.
But you
do. Have you had to Fred Meyer lately?
Yeah. But you do need to have that important skill. It's just that it's when you have the hypervigilance, your whole body is going to react, because it could be just how you're feeling in the room or something that's triggered. So we need to discriminate. We need to have that skill, but it's a degree.
I was going to say, I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. You know, the VA denied the existence of PTSD for many, many years. When did they first officially recognize it?
Does anyone know?
I'll take a rough guess and say maybe the 80s.
That sounds about right to me, too.
Around that, I'm not mm-hmm. sure.
But I also wanted to just comment on what we were just talking about, in that these things happen to you at such a young, formidable age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were in our late teens, most of us. I'm talking about you guys now, really. But
I was a 20-year-old.
A 20-year-old. I mean, you know, from this vantage point, that's a baby. You know? And
that's who fights the wars. If you look at if you look at the crews on the bombers during World War II, you know, they're all in their early 20s.
Absolutely. And God, talk about the Civil War. And anyway, but seriously, that it stays with you so long has to do with you being so young and so open in the way that young people are.
Yeah, that's the only way they'll get you to do something. They would asked any of us to do some of the things we did, even in basic training, we'd say, what? Mm-hmm. Are you kidding? I'm not doing that.
Right, that's live ammunition. Are you kidding?
And that's the development of the brain, too. I mean, at that young age, your brain isn't completely developed. Of course, now we know that it can continue throughout your life, but as all these wires are connecting in your brain about life, you're in constant trauma every minute where you have to be careful.
I also think that historically anyway, especially in Vietnam, this was a male experience. And
women too.
Not that many,
yeah,
though.
I talked with women who were nurses.
Nurses,
and
yeah.
Totally screwed up ever since.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I think there were 8 women killed in Vietnam, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't that they felt the presence of the danger, although I'm sure that they did to some extent, but it was, you know, this is in later life when I talked with women who said, yeah, I was there. I worked in, and they mm-hmm. would say, you know, I worked in this hospital that was there. That, and it was just exposure to the, it was like Gary was saying, you know, I mean, you see somebody and their leg's gone, and or their arm is gone, or their chest is hanging half open or whatever. I mean, you know, I remember the first time that somebody said, here, take this over to the hospital. And I went over there and they were unloading a helicopter. And I found that to be quite traumatic. To do that all day long for, you know, a year tour.
Sure.
Year tour.
But I'm thinking more sort of on the cultural level, as far as the traditional male psyche has sort of been groomed to be able to go into this situation and maybe not want to be there particularly, but still the values that you're grown up with kind of presuppose you to not question the whole thing. And
well, men are basically indoctrinated from, I believe that a lot of it is genetic, but they're basically indoctrinated to be warriors.
Right.
That's, I mean, you know, I don't know. I had lots of cap guns when I was a kid, and you're dead. Clank, I'm a tank. You know.
Yeah.
We played at it, and there was a certain amount of romance about the whole business of going to war until it was my name on the piece of paper, and then it was different. But
well, right. Look at the films. The
yes.
heroes
yeah.
were the ones that
we were. Yeah, John Wayne.
Yeah,
we had to be like John Wayne.
All that. Mm-hmm.
Those movies were designed to get people to be rah rah and join up. Mm-hmm. To me, they scared the hell out of me. And from the time I was 10 years old watching these war movies on television, I thought, I don't ever want to do that.
And here I was watching Reefer Madness.
Well, on that note, this is really, I think, turning to a really interesting direction. I wish we had another hour to talk about that side of things, and we don't. So I'd like to thank Ray Gary, Dan Sherman, and Gary Blanchard, as well as Marcia Thibodeau, for being with us tonight. It's been great. And also thanks to Pi White, our technician and co-producer. This has been Lee Tooley, your host. And thank you all for coming and sharing your thoughts, and thank you all for listening. This has been Reality Check on KCIW.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.